Te reo ererangi o te mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Morin Rout, and we are choosing some of our favourite novels for 2025, and we hope that you're adding these to your list of holiday reads and that you're giving yourself plenty of time to sit in the sun or sit in the shade or wherever you like sitting and getting stuck into all these marvellous books. The authors we've chosen are Dominic Hoey, Gina Butson, and Tracy Farr. Dominic Hoey's new book, 1985, is heartbreaking in all the right ways. It's set in Grey Lynn before gentrification turned the suburb beige. It's a coming-of-age story, a gritty tale of survival. It's funny, heartwarming, and challenging. Dominic is a poet, novelist, and a youth mentor. This is his third novel, but he spends a lot of his time working with the Learn to Write program, which has reached thousands of young writers. Dominic, welcome.
Thank you.
Haere mai.
It's reached some old writers too. There's no age.
Oh, I see. It's not just for young writers.
No, yeah.
An old person like me could come and be.
I think the oldest person I've worked with was 81.
That's a good age. Mm. Yeah, plenty of creativity there.
A lot of stories.
And we'll talk about that later. But 1985, I really like this title because there's 1984 and then there's 1985.
The sequel.
Yeah, the sequel. So, I mean, I know it's clear it's the sort of year in which it's set, but did that take you a while to decide that that would be the title?
Yeah, I think the original title was Homesickness, and then we had another bunch, we had quite a few other titles, but that just kept coming up because, you know, obviously, you know, the relation to 1984 was quite nice. It looks really nice, do you know what I mean?
Which
I
think that works.
It's just as important, right? Because obviously, you know, people do judge books by their covers. But I think primarily I think that that is the last year before New Zealand was swept with neoliberalism and Rogernomics, you know. So I think, and a lot of stuff was happening historically around that time too. So, yeah.
Yeah, it opens with the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior. Mm. And that's a sort of critical point in history, but it runs just it runs below your storyline. It just pops up every now and again because you've chosen Obi, the young boy, to tell the story. And, of course, the Rainbow Warrior is not sitting heavily in his mind.
Yeah, and I just sort of wanted to show that, like, when you are poor and you're just trying to get by, that these big things can be happening in the world, but, you know, it's even, you know, obviously he's 11 years old, but even for the older characters, you know, they've got a lot of other stuff to worry about, like a lot of bigger problems.
Absolutely, like staying afloat and getting food on the table and trying to stay well, and it's a struggle from day to day. This is set in the suburb that you grew up in, and clearly you were around in those times.
Yeah.
So you've drawn a lot from your experience.
Yeah, what I tried to do is I took the world that I grew up in and you know, some of the experiences, but then I created within that a fictional environment, you know what I mean? So it's not autobiographical in the sense that, like, Obi isn't me. He's, like, a lot cooler than I was, you know what I mean? And he's a bit older than I was at that time. But, There's a couple of things in there that are sort of based on real events, but I think it's so much more fun to create a fictional world and explore that. Mm. I find writing memoir stuff really boring.
Oh, wow, yes, it's just spending time with yourself rather than somebody different.
Yeah, and I think that, like, it's often difficult, like, when you put stuff on the page, it doesn't translate as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, even with that, there was a couple of things we put in there, like some of the violence with the teachers at school, and it just seemed too much, you know, even though it's real. So, yeah, it's interesting.
How was it to inhabit 1985 again?
Oh, it was fun, man. That's the most fun I've had writing a book, for sure. You know, I think, like, I really know what I'm doing now as well. I think with the first book especially, I was just, like, making it up as it went along. And I think with this one, I was like, I've got some chops now and I can put them into practice, you know?
Mm. And even though you were there and you lived there and you did a lot of the things that are in this book, I guess you still had to do quite a bit of research to make sure that your memories are right, because we can't always trust our memories.
Totally. Like, I mean, like, it's funny because I was like, yeah, I remember this and this. And then I'd go and talk to people, or I'd go, you know, watch videos, look at archival stuff, and I was like, my memories are so wrong. But I'm really lucky. I've got this big group of really supportive friends who read my early drafts, and so that was really helpful too, because most of them grew up in Greylin and are from the same, you know, socioeconomic background as me as well. So that was really helpful.
I said it's heartbreaking. I said it's heartwarming. It's also very funny.
Mm.
I guess to live these lives and survive, if you don't have humour, where are you?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like, I didn't want to write this really bleak, depressing book. You know, I have no interest in, like, poverty porn or any of that stuff. And I think that, like you say, like, within those communities, I mean, there's heaps of humour, there's heaps of beauty, there's love, there's all those things, you know, just as much, if not sometimes more so, than middle-class communities. And I think that often gets forgotten. You know, if you just watch the news or whatever, you just think it's just all misery and criminals and whatever. But, yeah, and I just like writing funnies. Like, I like making people laugh, you know.
Well, you made me laugh a lot, because I just about there's not many characters in this book that aren't funny at some stage.
Mm.
They might be unintentionally funny, but, you know, life just serves them up crap a lot of the time, and they have ways of turning that into humour.
Yeah, I think that absurdity is something that is, I guess, autobiographical to my life, in the sense that, like, growing up, it was, like, always all these, like, kind of, like, mad people in the house, and there were the dogs and all this stuff happening and all this craziness. And so I tried to sort of capture that feeling of chaos, and, yeah, like, it was, you know, it was a fun way to grow up in some senses.
Tamaki Makaurau is a lot warmer than and more tropical than Otatahi. So a lot of stuff happens out on the street in this book, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I guess, like, we used to do a lot of walking, you know, so we used to walk all around the whole city, and I didn't really think anything of it until sort of years later we made a, you know, like, when we were teenagers and we had this one friend who had a car, and I was like, oh my God, it's so easy to get around. But yeah,
there is mostly walking in here. The times that Obi and his family get in the car is pretty fraught, because the car has been put together by his father. And there's no guarantees you're going to get there or back.
Yeah.
Tell me, well, because I don't want to explain about Obi and his family. You tell us what the family circumstances are.
Yeah, so I guess, like, the elevator pitch kind of thing is, like, it's about this kid, Obi. He's 11 years old. He's a video game savant, like, playing Spaces. And we sort of start, you know, we join him on the day after the Rainbow Warrior bombing. And it's the same day that his dad's friend Gus gets out of prison after 7 years. And there's all this tension between Gus and the dad, but you're not really sure why. And then Obi goes through Gus's stuff to try and find money to play Spaces, and he finds a treasure map. And then him and his best mate Al go on a sort of series of adventures.
Treasure.
Yeah.
At the same time, he's lying with his mum, who's sick in bed, and she's reading Treasure Island to him.
Yeah.
It was a very tender, well, there are a lot of tender moments in here.
Yeah, so I sort of wanted to have a grounding character in there as well, not just that everyone's sort of crazy. And so, yeah, the mum sort of serves that purpose, I suppose.
Yeah, and, you know, you don't make it, I mean, you don't string us along with the idea that there's going to be a miraculous cure to what's going on with her. You're very careful to just keep sort of dropping the tone down all the time.
Yeah, well, I guess, like, because a lot of people, not a lot, but, like, quite a few, I guess, of the adults in my life growing up had hepatitis C, and some of them didn't make it to when Interferon, The Cure, came out. And so that was sort of something that I guess I grew up around. And when I came to write this, just put that in, you know.
And they hold on to hope, though, even though you don't make us readers hold on to hope. But I guess and his dad and his sister Summer, they have their own ways of dealing with what might happen.
Yeah, I guess you do when people are sick, you know.
You do, absolutely. Yeah. His dad is a poet. But he's a kind of, he's a poet. That's full stop after that. I shouldn't say, but he holds on to his poetry throughout everything.
Yeah, I sort of like, I guess I've met quite a few people, like growing up there were people around and even like nowadays, like, who just are sort of natural poets, like that. Poetry just kind of comes out of them, and they don't necessarily have any designs on writing a book or really doing anything with it. And I've always just found it so fascinating because I've had to work so hard to become a poet, you know. But I've always been intrigued by people that it just comes out of, and so I thought it'd be quite an interesting trait to give the dad. And I think to counteract that kind of idea of, like, you know, because in some ways the dad is kind of like kind of toxic and stuff, but then he's also as poet who cooks and cares for his family in this way while also kind of ruining their lives in other ways, you know?
Yes. Every time there's an up, there's usually a down that comes as well. And he's got these, well, crazy friends, Med, Sam and Gus. And so the household is never, very rarely quiet.
Yeah.
It's chaotic.
Yeah, so Mad Sam is the one character in the book who's based on a real person, who was Mad Tom, who's passed away now. But he was a fixture in our house growing up. And I don't know how he ended up in the book, but he just sort of popped in at one point. And then I ended up telling my dad, I said, I think I'm going to put Mad Tom in the book. And he's like, oh, yeah, cool, yeah. Should do it.
Oh, he's a brilliant character because there still are Mad Toms, Mad Sams out there that... Nobody can do anything for.
Yeah. But, and also, like, you know, like, the real Mad Tom, he was quite a brilliant person, do you know, but he had manic depression, you know, so he's sort of up and down and all over the place. But, you know, he'd turn up and he'd make these amazing carvings or he'd play chess and beat everyone at chess, but then he'd start sort of ranting about the voices in the walls and stuff. So, yes, yeah, he's a real character.
It's time to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the beauty of the book in lots of ways, is how much love there is in the book, you know, between all the characters, and they're so well visualised, created, you feel you know those characters really well.
Yeah, no, I worked really hard on them, you know, I spent a lot of time just trying to like, make them... I guess the dad came together really easily, and so the kind of challenge was to get everyone as interesting as the dad, which was kind of cool. And so, yeah, I think we did about 30 drafts of that book, and a lot of that was on
did
character.
You? 30?
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
Because you do it so, it's sleight of hand, really. You kind of don't notice how you've done it.
That's the 30 drafts.
Yeah, that's right. So when I read it, you know, like Grandma, who's not in there very often.
Yeah.
But there's some just lovely little one-liners about her, and she's immediately there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was really important, yeah, that all the characters kind of, you know, were alive and coming off the page, you know, and so that was what, yeah, like I say, it was one of the things we worked on a lot.
Yeah, and getting back to the love, I mean, Obie's mum is just, yeah, a lovely person. His dad loves her so much, and yet he's constantly sort of buggering things up.
Yeah.
But she loves him back. Obie's really wanting to be part of his dad's life, but that he can't sort of keep it going, or he can only do it from time to time, really.
Yeah, yeah, I guess, like... the dad's a complicated character, you know. Yeah, I think they're all quite complicated. I mean, even Obie, you know, he's sort of like the hero, but he behaves very selfishly in that
He's
book.
He's 11.
Yeah, but also I guess I was trying to mirror like the selfishness of the dad who he emulates in his relationship with his best friend Al. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, like how so he quite often lets his friend down. And yeah, so it was interesting because I was like, oh, I don't know if this is going to, how this is going to come across, you know.
Yeah, exactly, because Al is absolutely lovable.
Mm.
He's very forgiving, isn't he?
Yeah.
And I love the fact that his family and the others up the road, if anybody is under threat, they're kind of right there, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, that's what it was like growing up, you know, I think, in good ways and bad ways, because sometimes you end up in situations where people are like you know, oh, we got to go and beat up blah, 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 and I'm like, what? Like, yes. I just thought we were going to go play Spaces, you know?
Yes. So, exactly.
But, you know, and on the other hand, it's like, you know, you'd just wander around and people would feed you and you'd go to the movies or whatever. I think that's something that I it's such a shame, you know, like I've got goddaughters now and I kind of wish that they could experience that way of life, but it's not.
Is it really gone? Or are there pockets of it? I mean, it's gone in Greyland.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, obviously, there could be stuff happening that I don't know about. But I think in Auckland, it's so spread out. And I think because everyone's has been pushed out of their communities and then going to other communities, I think it's just really hard to, you know, you need to be in a place for a while to build that. And I think, you know, I mean, I think I've moved every year at least once a year, if not twice a year, for my whole adulthood, you know, so.
Mm. Well, I was remembering, because I was in Auckland in the late 60s, early 70s at university, and I knew lots of people who had flats over in Greyland.
Mm.
And I was just thinking the other night, I bet there's very few university students could afford to live in that inner city that we did. They've probably gone...
I think they do, there's just, you know,
eight
people in a three-bedroom house and stuff. Or they just pay crazy rent because, like, you know, like I work with a lot of young people through Dead Bird Books, my press, and, like, yeah, some of them I'm like, how can you pay that much rent and you're, like, 24, you know, it's ridiculous.
Yes. Oh, well, I agree. I was there in halcyon days in that respect of being able to live in the inner city in dreadful flats. But
I know, Amanda. Yeah. They weren't big on insulation. Eh?
No. But was the damp as much as the cold?
Yeah.
I love the way that you just... You know, and maybe I'm not expecting you to explain how you do it, but in all those sort of chapters, I could underline, I've only put a few in, but I could pick out every so often this phrase or a sentence or something that is so, It just pulls you up because you think, oh, my gosh, that is actually how it is.
Mm-hmm.
Or you've put it in a way that you think, oh, my gosh, I've never looked at things that way. They're like little detonations on the page every so often.
Yeah, like I think that, like, so, I mean, how I do it is, if you want me to explain, it's like you take aphorisms, like aphoristic writing, like little wisdoms.
Yes.
And you combine that with poetry. But then the hard thing is to smooth it. Again, that's why the 30 drafts, because you've got to smooth it into the writing so that it still hits you, but it doesn't jump out. But it's a technique, it's a literary technique called burnt tongue, so like, because it should stop you in your tracks when you get to them. Amy Hempel, the short story writer, is like a master of it. So that's where I learned that technique. But see, with this book, because my last book, Poor People With Money, like the main character is like a Muay Thai fighter who... left school when she was 15, so I wasn't really able to do that in the same way because it wouldn't make sense for her to be poetic.
No,
but with this one, I was just like, I'm just going to make the narrator poetic because I want to like sort of show off and but use those techniques more. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I do because you've done it and it really stands out to me.
Well, that was one of the frustrating things with Poor People With Money. Like some of the reviews, they were like kind of act like I was like, I didn't know what I was doing and I just sort of stumbled in and I was like, man, that's on purpose, you ignoramus. But
yeah. I do know what I'm doing.
Yeah, hard out, you know.
Well, I think it's on show here.
Oh, thank you.
And it gave me such pleasure. So thank you, Dominic. I hope you'll launch tonight at Scorpio Goes Well. And I'm sorry, I can't be there because I've got to go home and stoke the fires.
Yeah, no worries.
But, and I hope this this novel gets the readership it deserves. The book is called 1985. It's by Dominic Hoey and it's published by Penguin Random House.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
It's such a treat to talk with Wellington writer Tracy Farr because I've been a big fan of her writing since her debut novel, The Life and Loves of Lena Gaunt. That was long-listed for the Australian, the prestigious Australian Miles Franklin Award. And in it, I learnt all about the theremin, something I had no knowledge of. But I found her writing really intriguing. She was a scientist, and her training and knowledge is very much on show in this latest novel, Wonderland. The book won the New Zealand Society of Authors Laura Solomon Cuba Press Prize, which is a really long title. So welcome, Tracy. And I think we need to pay tribute to Laura Solomon and the Cuba Press, don't we?
Yeah, kia ora, Morin. It's just a delight to be back on Bookends with you. It's been a long time. And thank you for that lovely introduction. Yeah, I really would love to pay tribute to Laura Solomon and this prize in her name. It's awarded for writing that has a unique vision. And so it thinks outside the box, and that seems to me to have been a hallmark of Laura's writing and her writing life. She wrote novels, she wrote short fiction, she wrote poetry, she was a playwright. She really thought outside the box, and she pushed her writing career, which was cut short when she died too young. It was cut short, and I can only imagine where she might have gone with it. And so this prize in her name is, for me, it's meant an enormous amount because it's made space for this odd novel of mine to be published in New Zealand, which is really the place and the space that's nourished the novel bubbled up in the writing for me. Yeah,
and I always think, you know, while we talk about people, they stay alive. And so, you know, having a prize like this in her name is so important to keep who she was and what her vision was.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
This book has things that are true and untrue. So it challenges us to go along with you because there was a place called Wonderland in Miramar, and we also have to imagine that Marie Curie came to New Zealand to recuperate.
Yeah. So one of my favourite things to do, I guess, in my writing, in my novels, not so much my short fiction, is to let myself go to that place where there's a mixture of the real life and the fictional. And I love to create a world in which there's just enough of that real world to kind of ground the novel and to make it feel rich and thick enough to be real, while kind of stretching the truth as much as I can to sort of, you know, there's that lovely tension which I just can't stop myself playing with. There were a couple of kind of inciting snippets of information that kind of landed in my writer's brain when I was, and that prompted this novel to come about. A long, long time ago, more than a decade ago, I overheard a conversation in a cafe. Someone in Miramar, where I'm coming to you from at the moment, Miramar Peninsula in the east of, to the east of Wellington City, juts out into Wellington Harbour. And I was at a cafe and I overheard a conversation. Someone said, oh, down the road where after the amusement park closed. And I thought, amusement park in Miramar? Hold on, that's not something I've ever heard about. And a quick Google showed me that there was an amusement park in Miramar for about 5 years, from 1907 to 1912, and it was called Wonderland. And there was a rich history, particularly visual history, of it in postcards and photographs of the time that were readily available. There was a rich history as well in the paper's past archive of digitized newspapers and magazines of the time. And I started to fall into that world of Wonderland and wonder how I could roll it into a novel. So there's that. There was that fascination with something I had no idea had been in my backyard just down the road from where I'd been living for a long time at that point, and have been living for more than 25 years right now. And then the Marie Curie connection, that was one of those characters that just stepped into the novel and hijacked it. My novel the first way I started thinking about it was that I was interested in family. I was interested in sisters, something I don't have, and something that I was really interested in exploring, that sister relationship. And I was interested in triplets. And then this figure, Marie Curie, hijacked the novel, I guess. I'd had an interest in her for a long time. As a child, I had one of those Reader's Digest best loved books compendiums with four. And this, the one that I had, was volume one. And it had four stories in it: David Copperfield, Treasure Island, The Call of the Wild, and Madame Curie. So it's the biography written about Marie Curie by her younger daughter, Eve. And so she'd been in my life for the longest time, but also I'd been collecting snippets about interesting women scientists and their interesting lives, their often extraordinary lives. And I knew that when I found Wonderland, that I somehow wanted to weave that sense of wonder and that sense of curiosity into it. So curiosity comes from Wonderland, the amusement park, but it also comes from the Alice's Adventures in Wonderland connection. Because once you've got an amusement park called Wonderland, you cannot go past the Wonderland connection, the Lewis Carroll connection. And so I started, like Alice, to go down the rabbit hole and start to think about some of those ideas from Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And then my job was to mush it all together and try and make a novel that could, you know, take off and walk on its own two feet. So
I can't imagine you wrote this in a linear way.
No. No, well, the story is told in with three separate voices, or through three separate narrative positions. And in fact, one of those narrative voices is three voices, because it's the voice of the triplets, these 7-year-old triplets, Ada, Una and Hannah. So there are multiple voices in the novel. And the first voice I had was this multiple first person plural, this we voice of the triplets. So that was where I came into the novel. In fact, I happen to have my very first notebook here from January 2016, and on about page 3, after I've decided that there are three sisters and that they are triplets, I have what are almost the first lines of the novel. So it was really that triplet voice that came to me, and it's an odd voice, and it's a particular voice, and so following that voice was reasonably linear. But then once Marie Curie hijacked the novel, as I've said, I then had to find her voice. And so I would tend to write those voices separately, and then my job was to interweave them. Now, the third voice that tells the story of the novel is the voice of the triplets' mother, Mattie, Matilda Lovelock, who is a doctor, and into whose care Marie Curie has been delivered, if you like, by a mutual friend, Ernest Rutherford. And so the voice of Mattie was actually came to the party quite late. For a long time, the story was just told through alternating viewpoints of the triplets and Marie Curie. But when I decided to introduce the voice of Mattie, all of a sudden everything fell into place because she had a perspective that neither the triplets nor Madame Curie could offer at particular times of the novel. So all of a sudden I had a better way into the novel, I think, for the reader in particular. But she also offers another kind of richness to the novel. Her voice is more familiar, more straightforward, I think. So no, it wasn't written in a linear way at all. And one of the things that I struggled with was how to balance those voices, how to interleave and interweave them when one or other of the voices kind of stood back a little bit and let the other voices speak, and when it was important for a particular voice to be really up in the mix, if you like, and for us to really hear from that voice. I enjoy that part of the puzzle of putting a book together, but you know, because it's all about balance and dynamics. Yeah,
it is. And you know, there is a rich cast of characters. You know, the children's father, Mattie's husband, is Big Charlie, Carnival Charlie Lovelock, who's you know, a huge figure and huge presence in the book, and then all these other sort of very integral parts of the story, the Mrs. R and the Camelia, Jane Deere. It just is so colourful, so rich, so wonderful. And then there's the science you put in it, because you can't resist that, can you? The blue glow of the radium that kind of permeates its way into the story.
And that was part of creating, I guess, this sense of wonder that from all my reading, it seems that Marie Curie carried through her life and that she had shared with her husband, Pierre Curie, who had died very tragically about 6 years before the events of my novel. And so in the novel, she's still very much grieving his loss. But together, they had this sense of scientific, not just scientific curiosity, but just curiosity, plain and simple. They were just fascinating and fascinated people, and they were, you know, in the best of ways, they were just following where that curiosity and that wonder took them. I wanted to get that sense into the novel, but I also didn't want it to weigh the novel down. I wanted it to sit lightly, reasonably lightly in the novel. I hope I've achieved that. I really enjoyed populating the novel with people who are drawn from real life characters. So Ernest Rutherford obviously existed in real life, and he's off in the wings. We hear from him, but he's not on stage in the novel. And I loved painting a tiny little part of his life and his interactions in real life with Marie Curie. That was sort of a lovely little sidebar for me personally to draw in, and I did so much reading and got so distracted by Ernest Rutherford. I suspect there's probably another novel in that, but let's put that aside. The joy also of inventing other characters, So many of the characters in the novel are invented. Mrs. R, who is the friend and midwife who works with Mattie Lovelock, her partner Jane Dear the Camellia, I created her as very much a character in passing, who was someone who I envisaged working at Wonderland, and she was another character who demanded more of a role than I'd initially given her. You know, no, here I am. I am here. I am the partner of this character. You know, take notice of me. Write me in. And so it's always really fun to do that.
The book is, as we say, full of wonder, full of joy, full of curiosity, but it also is about grief and how we live with grief. You know, Marie Curie at one stage refers to the space of him, the gap, in describing the huge loss of her husband. And then there's other tragedies that happen in the book.
Yeah, and I think in writing this book, in the period in which I was writing it and revising it, I hadn't experienced grief that I could claim ownership of. Now that's a funny way to place it, perhaps, but there had always been someone between me and the grief who owned the grief more than I did. That's a terrible way to put it.
No, it's actually quite accurate. Yeah.
And so what I wanted to, something that I seem to go back to over and again in my writing is to write things that I don't understand or that I haven't experienced, in a way to try and experience them, or to try and put myself in that place, to try and explore, I guess, through curiosity, through wonder, you know, what is it like to be at the centre of that grief? And so I think a large part of writing the grief in this novel was doing that, was exploring that. It was honouring those close to me who had lost people too, and I have since lost people close to me, so it was writing grief in a way to discover it.
Well, it's very accurate, I have to say.
Thank you.
Actually, pretty well mirrors what it feels like to be in the midst of something like that. But, the beauty of writing about something like that is you write your way through it, as you say. And there comes back into life the colour, the curiosity, the joy and the wonder that the world can bring you. Especially the natural world.
Yeah, I hope so. And also some sense of the ways that people experience grief differently, and that grief is not a one-time thing. It comes, it goes, it waxes and wanes, it relives itself.
And it must have been fun sort of constructing the ending of the novel as well, because you can do whatever you like, can't you? Or do your characters tell you what? I mean, you know what happens to Marie, so there's no, you can't muck around with that, but the rest of it, you can take them wherever.
Well, it's interesting. Once I've made a big, bold, bizarre decision to bring Marie Curie to Aotearoa, on one level, it could free me up to do absolutely anything. You know, if I've done that, why stop? You know, why stop there? But strangely, it makes me hold more closely to real life events and everything else. It's like, no, you can have this big invention, but try and pull everything out, you know, try and keep everything else as close as you can to what happened or what might have happened. But then I gave myself another out because I created fictional characters who are my central family. There were interesting characters who were really involved in the real life Wonderland amusement park, but I chose not to write about them because I was interested in creating my fictional family. I wanted my triplets, and so I needed to create them as characters. And so, because my characters are fictional, I can do what I like with them to an extent. But yeah, there is that woo sense in which the characters tell you what happens to them and where they need to go. Many writers talk about this, you know, this sense of at times not necessarily being in control of what happens. And I think again, that waxes and wanes for me. I can move my characters around in the world that I've created, but yes, there are moments when you reach a place and you think, oh yes, of course, that's what happens. And so there does seem to be a sort of a sense of predeterminedness to it. Oh, this is what happens, of course. Mm-hmm. But it can just take a little bit of finding. Yeah.
So were you sorry to leave Wonderland, or did you feel that it was ready to be let go of and go out into the world?
Oh, look, I'm just delighted that it's found its way into the world. It was a long time in the writing and a long time in the revising, and there were moments when I didn't think it might see the light of day, but I'm so pleased that it has, and I'm so pleased that it's been so well received so far, because for me this is a departure. This book is set entirely in New Zealand, not just in Aotearoa, but it's set in Wellington, and not just in Wellington, but it's set in my part of Wellington where I claim ownership, which I don't have, but the place in which I've lived for more than 25 years now. It's a place that's very dear to me, and it's a place that's become home to me. And so for this novel to have that is very much about this place where I'm talking to, from where I'm talking to you now, is just so important to me. And it really feels like coming home to me. Yeah.
Well, I had a very joyful experience reading this book. I think you've done wonders. I mean, all of us talking about the book are going to constantly come back to using that expression, aren't we?
And I am entirely happy with that.
Oh, good.
I think it's wonderful.
It is wonderful. The book is called Wonderland. It's by Tracy Farr, and it's published by the Cuba Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
The Stars Are a Million Glittering Worlds is the evocatively named debut novel of Aotearoa kaituhi Gina Butson. Gina is a former lawyer turned writer, with plenty of previous creative writing competition and publishing credits in her kete, but after the very positive reaction to this novel, she looks set to become a well-recognised name among New Zealand book lovers. Gina joins me from Tamaki Makaurau. Tēnā koe, Gina. It's wonderful to have you on Bookends.
Tēnā koe, and thank you for having me, and thank you for that really generous, lovely introduction.
Well, it is. It is a real pleasure. Gina, the book is actually quite sad, though, isn't it? Would you describe it as a haunted story at its heart?
Yeah, I suppose so. It's interesting, different people's reactions. Somebody said to me yesterday, oh, I thought it was going to be more dark while I was reading it, but it's quite hopeful. And then someone else messaged this morning and said, I liked that there was a real darkness underlying it. So I think people respond to it in different ways. But yeah, haunted's probably quite a good word for it. I haven't heard that used before in relation to it, but it is, yeah, it's a lovely word and it's probably quite accurate.
Cool, because can you, do you want to just tell the listeners the events in your life that gave you the kind of first kernel of sadness that's at the heart of the story?
Yeah, it's a probably a bit of a jigsaw puzzle of events in my life that have just been sitting in my subconsciousness for a long time. So a lot of it probably stems from the death of my parents, which was obviously quite a, you know, two major events in my life. After Mum died in 2007, I went to Central America, much like the characters in the book, and spent some time, you know, just taking a break from everything and travelling around. So I was carrying the grief of her death, but also while I was there, I stayed in a town called San Pedro, again, like the characters. And while I was away from the town just briefly, because I went there and came back a few times, one of the people that we'd spent a lot of time with in the town died. And I got back from those travels, and I really wanted to write about my time there. But his death was the story that was just the thing that kept coming up. And yet it didn't feel like my story to write. So I didn't write anything about it at all. And then some almost 20 years later, it came up. A lot of death in the story. But the other story that's always
been... There sure is. There sure is. Yeah.
The other story that's kind of been sitting there the whole time is... Not too long before Mum died, my parents moved house to a flat section, more accessible. There was a man living next door who had been, he was in his 90s and had lived in the place for years and years and years. And when he died, some people came round to clear out the section, get ready for sale. And there was a garage at the back of the section which had plants growing up all around it and old rusted cars sitting in front. And so my parents, as they did from the kitchen sink, watched all this being cleared away. And then one day Mum called me to say they'd just towed out an orange Datsun, which looked like it was in pretty good condition. And the reason it struck in her mind was that they had had an orange Datsun, my parents, back in the 70s, not long before Mona Blades disappeared. And when Mona Blades disappeared, the police were apparently looking for an orange Datsun.
Wow.
And interviewed a whole lot of people. Yeah. And Mum wasn't accusing the man next door. In fact, she had said to me, it's not him, because they solved that case. I don't know if she mentioned Mona Blades by name. But I think it just, we got talking about how cold cases are often solved years later when the person who's been a threat to somebody is no longer a threat. You know, they've died, they've gone to jail or whatever. Yeah. And it just got me thinking about this idea of somebody staying with somebody that they don't trust or that they know has a secret, because there are reasons for that person to stay in the relationship. So yeah, the
wow, okay,
these things
that explains so much about the novel. Listeners, that is a fabulous background story, and there's so much more content to milk out of that particular story too, Gina, I'm sure, for your future writing. I guess because in this novel, it isn't the character who is murdered who is our heroine for this story, but you do draw the character who's murdered really, really fully. In fact, it feels unusual to have a strong point of view character for so long in a story who disappears, who then... did you struggle with that as an idea, to write a point of view and then have it just disappear, so the rest of the novel has to unfold without it? That felt to me like giving the readers an experience of grief. I just wonder whether that was your intention.
Yeah, I wish it was, because it sounds like a much more intelligent, considered thing to do. But I don't think it was. I think I was just writing through instinct. As I was writing, actually, there were different points of view that I took out. I think I just started writing what I wanted to write. Along the way, I might have had feedback, actually, about people liking her voice and wanting to hear more of it. If I had thought about it, I probably wouldn't have done it that way. It probably would have seemed too wrong. So I'm glad I didn't think about it.
Wow.
As a person who struggles, you know, to kind of write myself, that's a really interesting take on things. I'm glad I didn't think about it too much. Love that. So our actual heroine, Thea, she's a remarkable, capable, principled, loving, adventurous woman, and yet it takes such a long time for her to trust herself. How did you determine what was the right amount of grief and guilt to burden her with for us to understand and kind of empathise with how held back she is?
Oh, again, you're going to... I shouldn't answer. I should let you just talk about the book because you make me sound much better than I am, much more deliberate. I think, again, I wrote this during an MA at the International Institute of Modern Letters, so I had the advantage of a supervisor and other people in my workshop group giving feedback. So I'm sure along the way they would have made comments about, in fact, there were some comments about her taking on too much guilt and it being annoying. So that was helpful because I moderated, you know, some of it. But again, I probably wasn't, I mean, I must have been thinking about it. But yeah, some of it is just coming from my own experience. So I was just writing what I felt was right. But then there was an element of being conscious of she is, like you say, capable and independent and has her own career and so forth. And yet, and that's the balance I wanted to play with, you know, that people aren't all one thing, right? They can be outwardly have it all together, but there's this weakness or the second guessing of themselves or this Achilles heel or something. So
yeah, no, well, you achieve that really well. And we do empathise with Thea, regardless of occasionally going, wake up, you know. So also I just wanted to say the climbing story that we begin with is beautifully told. Are you a climber?
I used to be a rock climber for many, many years. So I have done some alpine climbing. Not so much, but that's how my climbing kind of started, was on Ruapehu. And then I moved much more into outdoor and indoor rock climbing. So that's not unfamiliar territory to me. And yet I wouldn't want people to think I was an experienced mountaineer.
No, but the story has a lot of authenticity in the way it's told. It's and it's beautifully rendered. And in fact, that's something that is getting a lot of notice about the book is how well you have done both characters and settings. Your the book is all its settings are beautiful, including the early climbing settings. Lawrence Fernley summarises your plot device as a journey marked by pain, secrets and guilt to a place of forgiveness, acceptance and peace. Okay. And, you know, I think that's a great summary, but it's kind of a tricky thing to have a novel's whole tension and momentum built around, will my character work out what she's worth? You know, like that's, it's a whole novel to answer that question. Is that how you thought about what your plot was?
Not, I don't think so. Again, I wish I had smart things to say about it, but I think a lot I was just writing what felt right and then doing finessing. It wasn't just, you know, sit down and write this thing. But for the ending, for instance, I won't talk about in much detail, but I didn't know what the ending was going to be until I wrote the ending, and I wrote the ending pretty much at the end.
Right.
So it's almost like the story was writing itself to that ending.
Right.
I think at one point it was more of a, not murder mystery as such, but that was a bigger thread. And then I realised it's not so much a murder mystery, it's more a story of a life. So, and a story of a character.
Yeah, yes, because it is. It's Thea's story about her journey. But it's interesting because you say that, because one of my questions was whether you intended the reader to imagine that there could have been a darker story here. And because all the way through there is that possibility. And we don't actually ever know properly whether that's true, but Thea's movement onwards is regardless. of that possibility. Did you mean for that possibility to be something that pulled the reader through the story?
Yeah, 100%. And I think when I was first writing it, that was probably more of a driving force. And now that, you know, that story that kind of inspired the novel in some ways, that was probably always at its core. So the sense of wondering too, and I do like the fact that people still wonder what the actual story was, what did happen, and people do have different views on that. I'm not even sure myself. When I was writing it, I didn't know what the true story was, and it got a bit stressful towards the end of the MA year when I had to hand in my thesis, and I was like, oh, now I need to finish this story. And I had, again, feedback from classmates, which is really helpful, but even then we didn't have a firm view. And that's what I mean about the story. The ending kind of just wrote itself in a way, it resolved itself in a way that worked out. But I like that there's this darkness underneath it and that you have that sense of wondering. A lot of the story I think of as these small decisions that, you know, you make one decision and it changes the course of your life. Even if it's not in a major, you know, dramatic way, but that sense of wondering is of a similar theme to me, the kind of the what ifs.
Well, and the title really plays with that, as well as how, as well as beautiful settings that you put your novel into. The title plays with that, what ifs. Yeah, because, you know, I think there is that Thea's journey is marked by how vulnerable she is to that risk, you know. So because of where she's up to in her own story, so the book's really sympathetic to her. But I guess one of the things, why do you think it's so hard for women, even really strong women, to figure out how to trust themselves?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I don't know, there's probably so much that you could answer that question with, just the way we've been. I mean, I was brought up to think I could, you know, to believe I could do things. I had parents who never questioned what I wanted to do. I've also had really great bosses who have been the same. They believed in me almost more than I believed in myself, arguably, which is an interesting point, isn't it? So, yeah, I don't know why we had the imposter syndrome, or even as an independent person, I can be quite responsive to somebody else, you know. Yeah. If they give me that indication that they need me, you kind of want to fulfill that need, right? Even if it's not the best thing to do. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer, or at least not in a nice, snappy, short
answer. But grief might have something to do with it. And your own grief might have something to do with that answer as well. So thank you very much for sharing that.
And I think certainly, sorry, in Thea's case, it is, you know, what if her parents hadn't died? What would, how would she be different? You know, what if she hadn't gone travelling and met the people that she met? So all these, all these what ifs.
You've had a well-deserved great reception to this book, Gina. In particular, as I've mentioned, the really rich characterisation, that ability to create tension just about somebody's journey. How are you finding having your first novel out there in the world?
Oh, I'm so thrilled with its response, because it's something I've wanted to do my whole life and haven't actively pursued. There were long periods of my life where I didn't write at all, caught up working or climbing or so on. So to finally sit down and done it and have some validation that it was worthwhile and it's worth pursuing, it is a dream come true. And I know there's so many great books that get published that I'm just enjoying it while it lasts, and then I'll sit down and try and do it all again.
Yeah. Oh, look, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. Listeners, the book is The Stars Are a Million Glittering Worlds by Gina Butson, and it's published by Allen and Unwin.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rath, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.